Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our Tuesday, June 12, 2012, Carrboro Board of Aldermen work session. This is not one of our regular business meetings, so work sessions are generally reserved for fewer agenda items of greater substance, and we try to take the opportunity primarily for, exclusively, for the board members to discuss these issues amongst themselves. We welcome your input on these issues. We're not likely to make any giant sweeping final decisions tonight. We're just going to have a discussion, and we'll look forward to getting phone calls and comments and emails from all of y'all after tonight, but about the matters that we discussed tonight. So that's our usual procedure. Agenda. Before we begin our printed agenda, though, I have a proclamation that I'm issuing. Is there somebody here in connection with the Older Americans Awareness Month proclamation? No? Okay. Is there anyone here who's 65 or older? No. The number of persons aged 65 in North Carolina increased 25% between 2000 and 2010 and to 12.9% of the state's total population. The town of Carrboro recognizes that citizens aged 60 and up are important to our community, and the Fragile Families Network is committed to providing information to our community to raise awareness of the needs of older Americans and resources that are available to help all individuals and their families maintain good health and independence in later life. And whereas older adults in Carrboro, North Carolina have an important role in sharing knowledge, wisdom, and understanding of the history of our community through interactions with children, youth, and adults from other generations, and whereas the fruits of knowledge and experience can be effectively transferred from generation to generation through meaningful social interactions, therefore be it resolved that I, Mark Chilton, Mayor of the Town of Carrboro, North Carolina, do hereby proclaim the month of June 2012 as Older Americans Awareness Month, and urge every citizen to take time this month to learn about the needs of older Americans and to engage with our senior citizens through enjoyable social interactions such as sports games, contests, and other forms of interaction.
Or you could just buy us ice cream. Yeah.
Absolutely. Stop by.
Or a beer.
Depending. All right. Thanks for indulging me on that point. Item A1 on our agenda is an update on proposed change to the solid waste collection operations. Mr. Major.
Mr. Mayor, members of the board, a lot of regional discussion about solid waste, so we thought this would be an appropriate time to let you know what we're thinking and get some feedback from you. And George Size has a PowerPoint presentation.
Good evening, everyone. I think this qualifies as one of those items with substance the mayor was talking about. I'd like to give you an idea of the proposed changes to our solid waste system due to the closing of the landfill on Unibanks Road come June 30th. So I'm here to present this tonight and get some feedback and comments from you so you have an idea what our plan is and how we hope to address this change in the situation. Four things I hope to accomplish tonight. Review the analysis, which is the basis for the proposed changes, and that's in the report. Briefly talk about the equipment we utilize and the staffing to kind of help give some context to what we're doing. Talk about the proposed changes in the dumpster operation and the residential collection. And then at the end, a summary of the changes and the timeline, and that's also in your report. This kind of tells the story here of what we're faced with, and that's going from a landfill that's relatively close, and if you look at the round-trip mileage, going out to Eubanks is 4.8 miles one way, 9.6 round-trip. Going to the Durham Transfer Station, which is what's proposed, is 42 miles round-trip, 21 miles one way. And then when you translate that into the time, you see the difference in time, 83 minus 22 is 61 minutes, just a little over an hour now added in a trip to the landfill. We have 16 trips, which is in the top line, as additional driving time is 16.27 hours a week, And then you put that into terms of annual, you have 846 hours then that are lost productivity, if you will. The driver is driving, but we're no longer picking up anything. So that's the basis for the need for an additional person, and that's on the two operations I talked about. Let me quickly show you here. I borrowed this map from Chapel Hill because I realized at 5:30 this afternoon I didn't have one. So if you look at the here's the center of the universe here. This is the center of Carborough right here. And this is the normal route we now take up to the Orange County landfill. This is Chapel Hill Center. Again, I borrowed from their map. And the Durham Transfer Station is over here on East Club Boulevard. So this route around here is 85, the 15501 bypass coming down through here. So if you have some ideas, everybody understand kind of where we're, hopefully where we're at. So the new route for us, and we'll be taking probably different ways over here depending on where our routes, because we're going to realign our routes, and you'll see that in a moment as to whether we will kind of follow this path, which is Franklin Street. We're trying to stay away from the center of town. We may actually end up around here on the bypass or going over Weaver Dairy Road to Irwin Road, something of that nature. But we'll be looking at different routes. But we've come up with the time. We've run our trucks on this, so we have a good sense on what's going to be involved. And then this shows somewhat the costs involved with this, and this will be explained a little bit better as we go along, but the need to hire an equipment operator, and that's with benefits, the salary there, additional maintenance and fuel with the additional miles, the purchase of a front loader truck, and that's annualized over there for over 8 years, which is the life of the truck, tipping fee difference, which is a negative number now because this is going to Durham, the tipping fee is much lower, and that's reflected down here in the bottom table here. Come July 1st, is 62.70, not 67.70, and $45 is the tipping fee. That's probably going to increase at Durham Transfer Station. So that difference there is somewhat to our advantage. So we have a much smaller annual cost than when we first looked at this 4 or 5 years ago when the tipping fees were much lower at the Eubanks Road, down around $50 and so forth. Plus, we've also been able to reduce our number of trips.
George, does that tipping fee include the cost it takes to ship it to the eventual landfill? Is that what that is?
I'm sure as part of, when you look at their budget, they have a cost per ton for all of their operation, and it's right about that number. So let me talk quickly here about how we do things and the proposed changes. This gives you an idea of the type of equipment. These four side loaders, and I'll show pictures of these in just a minute, that we use not only for trash but as well as yard waste. And the Condor trucks there is a special truck that works for both, and we started purchasing these several years in anticipation of this change. Then we have two front loaders. When you see the 056 there is way past overdue in 8 years in terms of replacement, and I'll explain that in a minute, a boom truck, and then a pickup truck. And hopefully these look familiar to folks. The one on the left is the side loader, and then the gate on this side is lower so that we can throw piles of brush of yard trash. I think that's somebody's bush. We don't want to throw that in, but piles on the side over here. This is our front loader. These forks here pick up the dumpster, bring it up over and dump it in, and then here's our boom truck. This is the current staffing, 7 employees, and this number would raise to 8 with the additional of an additional solid equipment operator, which would go from 4 to 5. And we have one supervisor who is also a working supervisor. So when we're short of staffing, Mr. Clark also has to jump on a truck every so often. This is a graphic here to show how we do dumpsters now. It is one truck a day, and you see the number of dumpsters that this person empties in a day and makes two trips to the landfill and gets it done in 8 hours. With the additional 2 hours, it will take 10 hours to do this. So the proposal then is to use two trucks, which is shown in the lower line, dividing things up, and these two people then will each work about 5 hours to get the same. It's the same quantity garbage, so there's still going to be 10 trucks to the landfill, 10 trips to the landfill. But only instead of one, there will be 1.25 full-time equivalents, which you'll see in a chart at the end. Then this is our single-family residential collection. And what we do now is pick up, you see the large number of stops at the top, one truck Monday through Thursday, and then as the town has grown, we've taken some of Wednesdays and put it on Fridays, and we're barely able to get Friday done now with one truck, so we had to go to two. And you'll see the little yard waste things in there because that's typically the days that we pick up yard waste then, Wednesday through Friday. You'll see that we also spend some time in these earlies if we have extra staffing to get a jump on it, but that's typically the pattern. Then what's proposed, and this is an option in, one in the bottom, is that we would strictly do yard waste on Mondays and Fridays, dividing up the town kind of like it is now. We can put everybody on that operation except for the one person on the commercial. And then we have what's called a 3-day solution here, two trucks each day, 3 days in the middle of the week. Now, the good thing from this is that we have three Monday holidays and one Friday holiday, and we would no longer then have to change scheduling. So that's the bonus of this in terms of disruption with the rest of the services. This now is almost a full day, so even though this is less stops than noted at the above, this person here has an hour longer trip. So it's almost still a full day, but not quite. And then here is another option we're looking at. We don't have this finalized. Again, it's a 3-day solution, but moving it to the latter part of the week. Again, two trucks during the day, roughly the same number of stops during the week, and then concentrating on Monday and Tuesday. But then this does present some challenges during Thanksgiving and Christmas when we have 3-day holidays. So we got a little work yet to do on figuring this out, but we're getting there. All right, this shows the full-time equivalents necessary to do to show you the people that we need, and the top is the proposed, and you'll see the dumpster service, and this 1.25 is basically 10 hours a day, two people at 5 hours, then the residential trash now Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, a little less than a full day for each one of those people. Yard waste then concentrated on Mondays and Fridays in terms of staffing. And then in between, we'll be doing our large loader stops with the boom truck. We still have bulky waste pickup. And you see here roughly then the total number of full-time equivalents to do these operations. You can't just do it with 4.9 people. You need 5 people to really do this. So if you come down to the next line, you see the staffing that's needed. So Monday, 6, 5, 6, 5, 6. Now, we only have 6 people now that do this, plus Chris makes 7. So that's the need here for the additional person to go up to 7. So you see, and then when you look at the full-time equivalents available, you have 7 people, but you also have people who are on vacation, sick, and so forth. So what that equates then to is the 5.95, just a little less than 6 people available to do the operation. And then when you look at the numbers above that, staff needed, we're pretty close here, a little over here, real close, a little over, and real close here. And that's just with adding then the one person. So this would be 7 plus 1 would be 8. Then looking at the bottom, you see kind of what we're doing now, and you'll see the difference in the totals. And then the staff needed here again. And then we have six people doing all these operations. Then the full-time equivalents available, again, taking into account roughly 15 people are gone 15% of the time. And that's sick, vacation, workman's comp, all those things that really happen. So we have 5.1 people, and we just barely make it here. And some days we're a little short, and those are probably the days that Chris hops on the truck. So try to give you an explanation for the need for the extra person. So here's a summary of the proposed changes and the timeline, and this was in your report. So we already have a good start on our plan. I think, as you can see, Mr. Clark, the solid waste supervisor, is charged with then finishing out this scheduling and getting it all ready so that we have something to show to you just before Christmas. The purchase of a new front leader truck or a loader truck, I think that is, and that will be in 12-13 and is in the budget, and that replaces unit number 56. I forgot to explain that when we have two trucks out, you got to have at least one backup. So that's the need for the additional truck then. 56 was going to be replaced anyway. So we will replace it, but we're going to hang on to it for an extra year so that we can kind of balance out our cash flow and our CIP and then replace it again, if you will, or buy a new truck then the following year.
Mm-hmm. Jackie?
I've had a couple kind of financial concerns with this. So when the county stops managing the landfill, they will own the landfill and they will own all of its assets. Is that correct?
And liabilities.
I mean, they'll own all the equipment.
I hope sign off on the deal. Yeah.
Okay. but I mean, they own all the equipment and everything, right? Yeah. But all the equipment's not going to be being used anymore.
They have as part of their plan the liquidation of that equipment to help pay for the capping of the landfill and so forth and so on.
Okay.
But a lot of that equipment is not that valuable after being used in the landfill for 10 years.
Okay.
Compared with its original purchase price.
Okay. So my next statement was, we've all been paying for all of that throughout all these years, and if there were any profits from the closing of the landfill, I would want to make sure that they were equitably distributed among the entities that have put money into it. My other financial question was, once the county closes, does the county spend any money on the landfill that does not come from the tipping fees?
No. I believe it's an enterprise fund.
Non-tip fee funds go to pay for recycling stuff, but that's all been taken out of the landfill. That's no longer done through landfill fund at all.
So. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Let me add that there are some operations that are still going to take place out there. Yard waste is still going to go out there, so they need equipment for that. And the construction and demolition debris also and recycling will be out there.
Okay.
So there's still some operations that will be taking place in the landfill.
Okay.
We should be clear. It is the commissioners are proposing to close the solid waste landfill, but there are some other operations out there.
Okay.
Yeah.
George, first, I want to thank you for putting the visuals with those with the numbers for the chart. That was really helpful to look at it in terms of all those trucks. One thing I couldn't find in here, and I was trying to figure out where it belongs, is the waste from the schools. What does that come under? Do we pick up from the schools?
We do pick up, and they are part of our commercial accounts and pay.
So what happens with that when the landfill closes? They are county. I mean, the county paid for the schools.
Well,
are we going to continue to pay? Are we going to continue to collect their waste? Or
yes, I guess anticipating.
Why wouldn't the county, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, they're paying us to do it.
They're like a commercial account,
a business.
Okay.
Multifamily apartments, townhouses where there are dumpsters do not.
So the schools are in that category?
Yes.
Okay.
So Can I jump in?
Yeah, go ahead.
Can you slide back in your presentation to where you talked about the staffing resources needed for the commercial routes?
Mm-hmm.
Because if I recall, the upshot of it was what, that you need about 1.25 staff positions?
Yes. Yes, that's shown in the top line.
And that's
there.
Unlike most services that the town of Carrboro provides, actually, that is a revenue-generating service to some degree. Is that right?
That's correct. About $111,000 a year.
Okay. So it's a service that pretty well pays for itself, it sounds like. I mean, it must be at least very close to paying for itself. Okay. That's one thing I'm going to be clear about. I have a couple other questions, but if you want to jump in on that. Okay. Can you go forward now to the slide that shows the possible three-day-a-week solutions, say that Wednesday won or whatever. Anyway, the middle week.
Okay.
Okay, so that, I don't have a strong opinion about option one or two, but I can see the obvious virtues of option one. But in a scenario like this, it used to be that I don't know actually what recycling day, how the recycling days work across our jurisdiction. They're obviously set and controlled by BFI and Orange County government who do that. But there was a time when, for sure, everyone who lived within, I don't know, half a mile of me or a mile of me had the same recycling and trash collection day. And then one day, 4 years ago or something, 2 years ago, I don't know, the county completely redid their...
It changed for some people, that's correct.
Oh, I shouldn't say they completely did it. Yeah. They redid it, and I have to say, I don't know, maybe plenty of other people must have been struggling for years with having different recycling and trash days, it's a real pain, and I'm wondering whether there's any opportunity as you look at this to try and... There's no way we can get everybody to have the same trash and recycling day, but I'm just wondering whether there's an opportunity to try and make it a little more convenient for a larger number of people.
Well, we can talk to the county and see. I think what this does, though, much the same it does for us, it adds stops per day and compresses what they do now into 3 days. And whether that's possible then for them to align that.
They're doing their route in 3 days?
No, we would be compressing ours.
Oh, yeah. And I'm not really even proposing that they change theirs. What I'm suggesting is just that if there's any way that we can just take into account, like, I don't know, if Lake Hogan Farms' recycling day is Thursday or something, if we can try to, when we set the schedule up, try to match it up in a way that makes sense. And obviously, what's most important is the consequences for the cost and in terms of the labor cost going into running this system. Right. But I'm just saying, if there's an opportunity to make it a little more convenient for people who happen to be,
Well, we can certainly take a look. It's crossed our minds about that. I'm not, sure.
We're I'm not trying to make a complete matchup or anything.
Yeah. Yes, I understand. And to to get the job done, we're lucky here, I guess, that we have excess capacity with our equipment by realigning it this way. Mm-hmm. We don't have to buy a truck. So, compressing into 3 days. If we try to start stretching to four, we're going to get in trouble, and we're already in trouble, as you can see, doing the top that way. So we can take a look. Now, I'll just be very honest with you. There's going to be, it's going to be a lot of people. They're going to have their trash day that's going to change, obviously, with this. Fridays and Mondays, are going to be distributed. And having, I guess, been through this before in a former life, you have to do a lot of education, and people are pretty stuck in their patterns, and it takes a few weeks, so there'll have to be some grace and forgiveness on our part and hopefully their part, residents, to get this implemented.
All right. Now, let me change gears on you in a kind of major way for just a second and ask you about something else, which is I understand that Chapel Hill hired some outside consultants to give them some advice recently about their entire solid waste management system, or so I'm told. I think I read something in the paper about how some of the results of that study are back. Did anybody else see that?
It's preliminary.
And it's in our bag, yeah. But
it's preliminary.
Well, but I mean, at what point do we drill down into? I mean, how do we go about I guess I'm like, this all makes sense to me. But what's worrisome is I'm reluctant to give you just an absolute green light and say, yeah, this is just go ahead and do this without us having had the opportunity to have a more, you know, some kind of discussion with Chapel Hill about where they're headed and whether there's, you know, for example, are they really going to look at pay-as-you-throw trash collection system in Chapel Hill, and what kind of implications would that have for us as their neighbors? Well,
can I address about the timing of the report? Yes, what you have is a preliminary, and what is coming to their board on June 26th, I was told today, is another report that will have more information, but it's not the final report.
Right.
So they are looking at a lot of the things that you suggested, and I think I noted in our report the most interesting one to me from all this is the idea of a transfer station. And but if they got the green light today, it would be several years away.
Sure. Yeah.
So
that's the point
so right we're planning, you know, one way or the other, we need to do something
in the interim
and sooner than later, because the window is sure. You know, it's closing.
Right, so we have to do this in any case.
Well, or something like this. And let me follow up. I swear I'll stop soon. One more question on this front, which is one of the things that worries me about equipment changes is just that if you're and I'm not knowledgeable about this. You guys are knowledgeable about this. That's why I'm not trying to ask you about it. But you know, you just don't want to wind up sort of having thought your system was going to work this way and bought a piece of equipment and then later deciding that, well, actually, you know, Chapel Hill is aggressively pursuing pay as you throw, and we can't sit here and ignore that reality and assume that trash won't just come flooding over our borders. We need to look at doing something similar, or we need to make some kind of major policy changes in response potentially, and whether you wind up sort of with a piece of equipment that isn't the right piece of equipment. That's all I'm trying to ask. Mm-hmm.
Well, can I address some of the equipment issues here you were talking about? When you look at this, the three-day solution down here, this was going to happen whether we went to Durham Landfill or not. And we've been looking at this as the town has growing, and, of course, it, you know, has slowed with the economy, what's happened in Winmore. But when we were anticipating 4 years ago, Winmore, Claremont, and others coming online, we were going to have to do this same thing because it already filled up. What used to be just 4 days is now 4.5 days, if you will, plus. So it's changed that much, you know, in the time I've been here. So we were looking at this change anyway. We would have had more capacity because we would have had less windshield time. Mm-hmm. So that was going to happen. Unfortunately, on the commercial, the dumpster service, it is right at capacity with we have. We have one person and two trucks, and there's just not a lot of grace to make any changes, and that's why it quickly jumps. When you add 2 hours to the day, it quickly jumps to doing something else. Now, I'm not sure if you're talking about types of equipment or whatever, but you know, if we get an extra truck, we had three trucks at one time. And,
I'm not so much concerned about the possibility that mm-hmm. that you have a truck that you wind up with a truck you don't need at all, one more truck than you need for your entire operation, just whether it's the right type of truck or whether, you know.
Here, if I may, Chapel Hill's indicated that they would like to have collaboration with Carrboro, and, you know, that's, I think, part of the discussion. We would like to see their final report, see if there are opportunities for us to partner with them. I think the question probably would be from an operational standpoint is how is that timing going to coincide with what Chapel Hill's doing? And I think we can do
I just want to make sure
the two together.
I don't have the right answers. I just want to make sure you all think about it.
Well, absolutely.
To address the purchasing, yes, the truck that we're purchasing in 12-13, which is just right around the corner, again, is a I want to point out, is a replacement for a truck that needed to be replaced anyway. So there is a little bit of grace in time-wise, as long as, knock on wood, Unit 56 holds together and we hang on to it as the spare truck And then hopefully some of the things that we're asking here will come into focus a little bit better.
Okay. Lydia, so, and then Dan. I'm sorry.
And then I want to say something too.
Okay. I have three questions. First one, George, is with regard to Alamance's landfill. I saw on their website that they, of course, are a landfill that only accepts, I guess, trash from their own county.
That's correct. Right. That's what we were told, and the county also looked at that. They were told.
And I assume that you followed up to whatever degree you could in terms of negotiation, trying to talk them into taking maybe the trash of our town or.
I asked politely and went out and looked at the landfill. I didn't.
How much more economically favorable would it be to go to that landfill if they were
Well, it's 15 miles. We checked it out. There's still, though, with that, it's a nicer route, though, than going the route we're talking about. It's an easier route. It's straight out 54, minimal traffic lights, but it's still 15 miles. And it was 25, 30 minutes one way, an hour round trip compared to 22 minutes. So it adds 40 minutes to the day instead of 60 minutes. And you still lose the productivity.
You still got to make these kind of changes.
That's right. Something still needs to be.
Well, one reason I asked was for exactly what you said. I mean, I kind of checked it out as you did. It did seem, at least according to MapQuest, closer. Did seem, you know, and every little bit helps when you're making that many trips. And, of course, their tipping fees are lower also. So,
yeah, we're
But anyway, they were on the website anyway. So I just, of course, I saw it was a county landfill, and they said they didn't accept, but I didn't know if they ever made an exception.
That's what he told me. I didn't know of any exceptions when talking.
Or were willing to negotiate. They'd be willing to negotiate.
I think if this board were interested that conversations could happen at the elected official level, There was an effort a few years ago to bring into Alamance County another county's waste or several other counties' waste or something like that, and Alamance County folks got organized and scotched the deal because they didn't want to get dumped on by half the state or whatever. Whether what you're talking about would be perceived in exactly the same way, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess my question is, I didn't know if it was the law of landfills that a landfill of that sort was not permitted by law to bring in trash from other counties, or if it were something that perhaps might be worth negotiating, as you say, at the public official level for what could be perceived really as a somewhat temporary, depending on what we end up doing, maybe a temporary basis.
Yeah. I have some more thoughts about that, but Dan.
Okay, and I have two more things after that. So that's just one thing I want to throw out there. People can say whatever they want to about that. Second thing was, along those same lines, George, and maybe you don't know the answer. I saw that in the Chapel Hill material, they made reference to something about South Wake. Is that? Do you have any idea what it is they're talking about there?
Yeah, there's a. And I'm sorry, I don't have the location. It's relatively far away, but they were looking, as I recall, to take over not an abandoned site, but something of that nature. I think I have the right one. Now, what we did learn from this report is there is another. There's a waste industry site, more on the southeast part of. Somewhere over in these parts here. Mm-hmm. It is also the same distance as the Durham landfill. But in our initial, and it was just within the last couple of days, so I don't really have solid information, but they are about the same tipping fee as Durham, but they were also willing to, they mentioned about negotiating something. Mm-hmm. So the risk there is it's on 54. Going out 54 and 40 and 147, and I think it's a little nicer trip, but we're worried about traffic. Of course, we're worried about traffic the other way, too, late in the day.
Right,
so.
Yeah, I agree.
But that's another possibility. It certainly isn't going to make much difference time-wise. Mm-hmm. It might be a little easier on our trucks, a little bit of time, much like Alamance, the same kind of thing.
Okay, all right, and then my last question was, the material indicates that the drop dead date for this to happen is July 1st, 2013, and I wanted to kind of confirm it. Is that the date?
That's my understanding. Yes, that's what they voted on and said the because that's been talked about and moved before that many times, and I think it was February this year that they voted that that's the date it's closing.
Okay, I think we've talked about this a little before, and I just wanted to know. So, yeah. Okay.
I had a question after Dan.
Dan?
Yeah, I'm getting back to the point about collaboration with Chapel Hill. This is a little bit premature today, but it seems like if they are expressing interest in the transfer station, it becomes important to talk about whether it would be advantageous to have a more formal framework like we do with the transit system. And I think advantages for that would be not only in terms of managing the transfer station, but also other solid waste opportunities like implementing pay-as-you-throw, which we'd want to do consistently across the two towns, if possible, could then be, we'd already have a body in place that was informed on the solid waste issues and all to provide oversight and policy guide direction on those kinds of questions. So, mm-hmm. I think at some point that's something we need to figure out for ourselves, whether it's advantageous for us, and then broach with Chapel Hill.
Could I just point out respectfully that Chapel Hill has a different collection type system than we do. They still have, they have some carts, but they also throw, they have rear loaders, and we have a fully automated system. And for what they're pursuing, unless they change, it's kind of apples and oranges, possibly, to do some of the things we're talking about. And that's why with the system we have, why pay-as-you-throw, which we've discussed, I think, at least twice since I've been here, is a challenge, because if you have bags or you have stickers, you have tags, it's inside a cart, and it's difficult to enforce and look at. So with a system where everything's out more in the open, or somebody's there and can easily out, before they push the cart on the tipper, can open the lid and take a look in, we don't have that ability. And so that's what makes pay-as-you-throw, which certainly has good virtues, but in our system, that's kind of a challenge. So it's not that it's impossible, I guess, but the way I look at it, it is at this point. But my bigger point is that Chapel Hill is a different system, and until they either align kind of with what we do or we go back to something, I'm not sure that all those things can work as planned or talked about. Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Well, that's part of the reason that, frankly, is part of the reason that I raised the technological issue 20 minutes ago, is because that's part of what concerns me, is just thinking about some of those issues. But Randy and then Sammy.
I spoke with some Chapel Hill Town Council folks since they had the meeting on this, and it is a preliminary report. They had a lot of questions that they generated back to their consultant, and I think probably on the June 23rd? 26th meeting, that's when they'll get those questions answered, and that they'll be ready to have a deeper discussion with maybe truer numbers. But I think, as Dan pointed out, and in my conversations with some of the folks in the Town Chapel Hill Board, is that having some kind of a group that can start to talk about potential partnering when they get that final report would be a smart thing to do, to have us in the conversation, or at least to have some folks, having that conversation. The other thing that they're talking about doing, which I think would be of interest to us, and I asked if they would look into having us invited, is they're looking to make a field trip to a transfer station. Sound familiar? But I think that way they could get, a sense of what it is. And I don't know which one they're looking at, but I know Roger's looking into it at this time. So I'm expecting that, if nothing else, our board will be invited. I think that's a way of moving partnership forward.
So back to this question of pay-as-you-throw, I understand Mark's point is like we're at a transition time, and this would be the time to change our current system to allow for that kind of thing. But I also understand the time constraints. But it leaves me wondering about Chapel Hill's approach. They're obviously studying it, and they have the same time constraints. Do you have a sense as to how they're thinking of when they consider a pay-as-you-throw and like the transition of technology, if that's needed? Or maybe they don't have that issue because they have a different system.
Well, because of the they have the different system where
so
bags
it's currently are compatible for
compatible
pay-as-you-throw.
With
okay.
with that.
Got
and
it.
I would think that, you know, I don't have an answer as to how they're looking or approaching it. Those are they had a lot of topics in this study.
Right.
More than just a transfer station, you know,
right.
looking at their operations and so forth. So
the other question I had was, I was looking at the options for throwing, like where we like other transfer stations and are, and the Siler City, you know, the Durham one's in the opposite direction of where the waste is eventually going to go. They then drive back through Carrboro and go to through Chatham County to the dump. So I was curious about Siler City. It's more on that route. And this question of, I'm assuming that they eventually take their trash somewhere other than where we're going to take it, because their tipping fee is higher than what the city of Durham's is. So I'm just trying to understand how it is that them being closer and taking into account the cost for gasoline and all that, that their tipping fee could be higher. Is it because they do take their trash to another
I'm sorry, you lost me as to who you're talking about here.
Which page are you on?
I'm on page B10.
B10.
And okay. The tipping fee for Siler City is 45 and 35 cents. And for the city of Durham, it's 42 and 50 cents. My question, the heart of it, is are these tipping fees determined by how far the transfer stations that are listed here take their trash?
I think whatever the, you know, ours is run like an enterprise fund. So I'm speculating here that their tipping fee covers their costs, which besides running the site, the transfer station, the garage, the skid loaders to push the stuff.
Right. How far you take it.
And then
it
goes into a semi and gets driven somewhere. So, yes, that's
right.
part of doing business.
And do they... Could a transfer station take it to a dump of our choice, or do they have their designated landfills?
I'm sure they do. I don't think it's something that we...
So it must be... I don't know. I'd be curious to know if that were an option for Siler City, because we, in theory, would save money if they could transfer it to the Uahi landfill, because it's closer to them. And it's just very mysterious to me how these costs are so different, because that is such a significant cost, the cost for the fuel and the transportation.
Well, Siler City is, I guess what I'm trying to say is 45, 35 is shown here as the tipping fee.
Right.
And you can tell by the distance, this is farther than going to Durham.
It's not farther if they were taking it to that landfill, because what you're doing is you're taking away...
You're talking about total travel distance is shorter if it goes that way, is sort of what the argument that he's making.
It amounts to 22 miles.
That doesn't somehow
I understand.
Translate into any savings.
It would amount to 22 miles instead of 35.
Well, except there are a lot of other factors.
No, I totally understand that, but it's... For that reason, I'd be curious to know if the Siler City Transfer Station could take their trash to the landfill we're talking about. They could have some savings there. But kind of related to that, I would hope in the future when we get reports that we start really thinking about including the other costs such as CO2 accounting in this. And I know that's part of our trajectory in the various departments. But I just want to point that out and encourage that more. And then lastly, the organics diversion opportunity, 25% of our waste is organic. And I know it takes a while to implement such a system, and we have a very short window. But I want to encourage us to really look into contracting with Brooks and having organic waste dumpster in each neighborhood, you know, ideas like that and exploring it. And I also look forward to whatever Chapel Hill comes up with. But hopefully that could reduce the amount of both labor and trucks that we use. I mean, it's an opportunity to contract with Brooks, perhaps.
Mr. Manager, and then...
I just want to
make sure on Chapel Hill that, to make it clear, that we can collaborate with Chapel Hill and still deal with the short-term effects of what we need to do at the same time. Okay. I think a lot of the Chapel Hill things, some will be short, but some will take a little bit longer, but we will have that discussion with them.
All right. Randy?
I just wanted to come behind Sammy and just say, you know, when I was looking at charts, you know, and we haven't really looked at this, but it, I mean, there's over, with the Durham Transfer Station, it's over 650 miles and burning fuel for over 650 miles and what the attended costs to that, not only in terms of the cost of the fuel, but in terms of, we're breaking our neck to have, programs that are going to save energy, and then, trucks are running at 700 miles, in a week. I think if we have those numbers, that would be a good thing to know.
Very briefly.
Yeah, just a quick follow-up to what Sammy said. I mean, that was another reason I, was suggesting maybe we try to nudge this Alamance idea, because our trash ends up in a landfill. It doesn't go any further then. And also, their commissioners or whatever might, like a couple of years of almost a windfall of tipping fees for a while. So I think that it has some possibility if they would consider it.
Are others interested in that? I've been sort of on the cusp of having that conversation at some point. The thing that makes me one reservation I have about that that notion is I think there was a strong sense when that landfill was sited in Alamance County that it was not an appropriate site, supposedly too close to the Haw River and so forth. And I don't know all the particulars of it. I don't live in Alamance County, and I didn't follow the issue at the time that closely. But so that would be sort of the, But then what are you going to do? Take every transfer station and compare every landfill that, I mean.
I think it's worth looking into, and there's especially, you were to talk with other elected officials in Alamance. I mean, after all, Orange County has a very unique relationship with Alamance. I mean, we're...
Oh, I wasn't going to speak to them on behalf of Orange County.
But I'm saying, but in terms of our relationship with Alamance, I mean, they're sure going to be benefiting quite a bit from their relationship with us, meaning Orange County. So it makes sense to at least see how they feel about it.
It does seem that... it might make sense to wait to have that discussion till we know the direction on the Chapel Hill transfer station, so we know whether it's a very limited request or a longer term.
All right. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point.
All right.
May I make one final point? I've been unusually quiet.
Unusually.
There could very well be a change in Orange County and the makeup of the decision makers, and with that there could be a slight change in these plans. My hope would be that someday they would see the wisdom of your proposal. But I think that even though right now everything seems to be set in stone, we just can't be sure that that's the case, or that the stone may be a little more wobbly than we suppose. So I would keep that out there.
All right.
And we could create a, you and I could be on a TOG, right? A transfer owners group or something.
Oh, God.
We would, yeah. Oh, sorry. Didn't mean to.
Causing me a fit just thinking about it.
All right. Yeah. George, was George done with everything he had?
Well, I'm thoroughly cooked up here.
Yeah. We need to
move the resolution.
A.
Second.
Been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All
right,
we'll oppose.
Thank you, George. Welcome.
Thanks, George. Welcome. Love those trucks.
Now, George, we usually keep you a little shorter than that one. All right. Item A2, review of land use ordinance provisions related to zoning permits.
Okay. Mr. Mayor, members of the board, you have a draft resolution calling for a public hearing to amend to rezone that particular parcel. It's also an ordinance. Marty Roof is going to be available to answer questions, but we do not have any formal staff report for you.
I'd like to move the resolution.
I'll second.
All right.
I mean, we can certainly have questions.
Are there any questions for the staff?
The resolution calling for the rezoning is the one, mm-hmm. Attachment A.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what we're moving right now?
That's what she just moved, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Saying the
you're not ready.
Okay.
You're not ready
no,
to vote.
I just need to
hear what you... I'm sorry, it was the one
real place. I have a question before we vote on that. David, is there...
There's going to be a discussion, don't worry.
Is there not a public hearing date in August?
I think it's the last Tuesday.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering why this is scheduled for September rather than August.
I'm trying to get y'all to discuss the issue. Go ahead.
Sure. The advisory boards often take a break that is similar to yours. And at this time, we don't have any items as of preparing the resolution for your consideration, we don't have any other items for that are set for a public hearing at the end of August.
Okay, so there wouldn't be a joint review and all
exactly.
that.
Exactly, and so it does present some
or
scheduling
would have
issues
to be special
we would have to, essentially we would be asking folks to come for a mid-month review in August. And we've had, some success in the past, but it's not always... people do have vacations scheduled often, we find, in August. So we were just being sensitive to their schedules. And
right.
We could certainly check with each board.
No, that's fine.
Find out
thank you.
But that was why.
Okay. So I guess you wanted some discussion. I'll just say, the reason I asked David to put this resolution before us, and I think I explained this in my email, is that I think it was abundantly clear from all the discussion we heard over the last few months around the Family Dollar proposal that the B3 zone is not appropriate for those properties. And in changing it to R10, we're not precluding it from ever having a commercial use there, but it would mean that an applicant would have to come in for a commercial rezoning at that time, perhaps a conditional rezoning, that we could ascertain at the level of this board that it was something that was really compatible with the neighborhood. And anyway, so that was my thinking in putting this before us, and I'm glad that it's already been moved and seconded because I think it's the way to go.
So that's the kind of thing that's helpful so that everybody knows what's happening.
Yeah. And I'd just like to thank Dan for being so quick to... and responsive to an obvious community concern, and hopefully this addresses that.
Could you pull up? Do we have a slide that shows? Do you have a map that shows the lot being
rezoned?
Well, I know it's in, but can you put it up?
Sure.
Yeah, it's four
yes.
lots.
Absolutely.
There are four properties there are five properties here, one of which is a sliver of land, which I think was part of the realignment, Highway 54 improvements, a very small piece here. Mm-hmm. But, I'm sorry, there are just five properties that are zoned B3 currently in this location.
Okay.
Developed now, properties in.
I guess I just want to point out that to the board that a somewhat similar issue arose very briefly, but it never got nearly as far because the store that wanted to build never, you know, they sort of backed out before it ever happened. But it was almost precisely the same issue, except that instead of being the corner of Alabama and Jones Ferry, it was over at Jones Ferry further down this way. I'm not talking about at the corner of Barnes Street where that Harris Teeter is. I'm talking about at the end of Prince Street. If you come up Prince Street to the end, I think it's Prince, you can walk a little foot trail that connects through there. Mm-hmm. That lot where that foot trail goes through, and there's a creek and all that. Well, they wanted to come in and build a, you know, that wasn't the grocery store. It was an auto parts. It was like a auto zone or something along those lines. Hmm. And at the time, I recall learning that because that lot was, I think it's also B3.
I think it's M1, that one.
M1, okay. So different zoning designation, but it's the same type of location, and it's going to, I can just predict, present many of the same issues. And I don't think necessarily that lot at the end of Prince Street, for example, that fronts out on Jones Ferry Road needs to be rezoned to some residential zoning to prevent some commercial use of that lot in the future. But I think, you know, I guess what I'm trying to get at is this. In Chapel Hill, when you build a building that is over 25,000 square feet, no matter the land use and no matter the zoning district, you're into getting a special use permit. Mm. You're coming before the Chapel Hill Town Council to have your project reviewed because of the overall size.
Okay. Right. Right.
And I don't know or care in this exact context what size building somebody wanted to do on Alabama Avenue or whatever. I don't know what size building they were talking about doing down at the end of Prince Street there back when they were talking about it. But it does seem to me that I don't know. I just wonder whether we should have some, whether part of the solution is to have some triggers that just have to do with overall size.
Right.
If you're beyond, you know, if you're really building
so could you
something
incorporate-
big, that you're going to have to come to us no matter what.
Mark, you know this- what you're saying doesn't pertain to the resolution.
Not directly. But I just think that I just want to get that out there that, you know, this is only going to solve this one little problem right here.
Well, can we?
Well, we have a whole other topic about how the staff elevates.
Am I getting grouchy about this somehow?
No.
You're not understanding the agenda item, I don't think, respectfully.
Yes, he is.
No, because we have a whole other topic to do with considering how things that might be a zoning permit can be elevated to either a SUP or a CUP. And that kind of pertains to what you're talking about, which is the broader question.
Okay, I only see three items on our agenda, Dan. So I don't know. I don't understand what you're referring to.
Yeah.
Maybe it would help us to just
vote on this. Well, no, I know it's fine, but I'm just saying. Like, I would have saved that for that agenda item, but I don't.
It's right here, attachment B, explanation of land use ordinance provisions that determine.
But that's part of the agenda item.
It's part of the agenda item.
Right, exactly. Okay. That's what I'm talking about. Why are you saying it's not there when you see that it is? I don't get it.
You're suggesting that my comments were not pertinent to this agenda item.
No, not pertinent to the resolution,
this resolution
that's before us.
Oh, my God. All right. All those in favor of the resolution signify by saying
aye.
All those opposed. Passed unanimously.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Clarify what this is about.
Right.
Rezoning.
What we just adopted or what we just passed was that we would have a public hearing on September 25th to receive public comments to rezone the four tracks from what it currently is, you know, B3 to R10. So the public hearing will be September 25th. Pardon me, to set the public hearing to receive the public comments to consider rezoning those four tracks. Yes. And just one quick comment I wanted to say was to the neighbors, how much I'm sure, and everyone we said by email, how much we appreciate this email with so much of your feedback and how we can kind of consider this in this whole process of improving it or just analyzing it or so on. It's really helpful.
I'd like to thank the neighbors and the community for, you know, just keeping an eye on the process. I also want to thank publicly the Board of Adjustment because I think they did a great job of being very careful and deliberative. Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry if I got in front of you, but sometimes we just have to jump in.
Sometimes we do that, yeah. I just had a question. So since the public hearing is not until September 25th, has the applicant turned in another application at this point? I know they withdrew it last week at the Board of Adjustment meeting.
No. You mean the applicant for the Family Dollar?
Right. Project, yeah. And what will this process, if we don't have the public hearing until September 25th, are you raising your hand to ask something?
No, I'm trying to go after you.
Okay.
Mark's refusing to look at me because I disagreed with him earlier.
How will that impact, and I don't know if this is a question for you or you, Mike, or both of you, but if we are not talking about this until September 25th and they turn in an application August 1st, what does this process look like and how does this impact their application? Is that clear
well,
as a question?
That's a very good question.
Well, it's a good question. Depends on what the application would be for. If it was for something which required a zoning permit, even the zoning permits require some fairly exhaustive analysis, but if hypothetically they turned in an application for a development that just required a zoning permit, and the zoning permit were issued, then the rezoning wouldn't affect the property. They'd have a vested right to go forward with what they were issued a permit for. If the permit is issued before the rezoning takes place, but our process is generally speaking, Marty can speak to that, not often that rapid. In other words, I don't know how long if what they turn in would require a special use permit, I think it's comfortable to say that there would not be a special use permit issued
before this
hearing. I don't know about the zoning permits. It would depend upon what they submitted and how long it would take. Marty can speak to how long it generally takes to review zoning permits.
Okay.
Anything involving special or conditional use has pre-application requirements where they have to go to the advisory boards, and the soonest that could happen at this point would be the first Thursday in September. So I think realistically, if they did, as Mike suggests, come in with something that only required a zoning permit, if it was a small, say, single-family home or something relatively small of that nature that didn't trigger the stormwater requirements, it's conceivable that that could get passed and could get through the process before September. But if it's anything commercial in nature, I can only imagine it's going to trigger our stormwater requirements, and we're looking at a multi-month process.
How many square feet of land disturbance triggers that?
It's 5,000 square feet of additional impervious surface.
Additional impervious surface, so you know, a driveway and a small building.
There was an exhibit shown during the recent meetings of approximately 2,000 square foot building with 7 or 8 parking spaces, as I recall, that I can't say as a matter of fact whether that exceeded the 5,000 square foot, but it was an exhibit showing that you could do a smaller project on that site without impacting the stream buffer. But even something of that nature.
But that wasn't offered by the developers.
No, that's my point, is that no one has approached us about doing anything like that.
Okay. All right.
I had one more question. At the meeting, the Board of Adjustment meeting, the lawyer for the developer brought up the question of whether there was an ephemeral stream on the property.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you can update us about, it seemed like they had talked to staff the day before the Board of Adjustment meeting, and I don't know if there have been conversations since then.
I've spoken to the town engineer briefly, the town attorney, and the planning staff has discussed it a little bit, but we've not had an opportunity yet to pull all the parties together, which is what needs to happen to really resolve the question before us. So it's an outstanding question as of tonight.
And so to clarify, there wasn't a proof that it was an ephemeral stream before?
There was, I hope this is a fair way to put it, there was a mutual agreement between the staff and the applicant early on in the process related to survey work that was done, that there was an ephemeral stream, that the drainage area exceeded 5 acres. And then very late in the process, yes, they suggested that a portion of the water was actually technically coming from a different drainage basin. So that's the question before us, and we have not yet resolved that.
And will that be resolved before this public hearing?
I would expect so, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks. So getting back to the purpose of the agenda item, which is to discuss possible ordinance changes needed to ensure that projects with strong public interest reach the Board of Aldermen. What we learned is that the relevant part of the land use ordinance, and Marty or Mike, correct me if I don't get this exactly right, that allow Marty the discretion to require a CUP only applies in the watershed zones. Is that correct?
Also certain downtown districts.
Oh, in downtown districts. And that it might be advisable, based on this experience, that we expand that to include any business zone, basically for any B zone or other business zone, that part of the land use ordinance would be modified, that would then give Marty the discretion to require either an SUP or a CUP according to his judgment. And it seems to me that that's an easy change for us to pursue this evening. So I wanted to put that out there.
Does it make sense to connect it to the zoning district it's in or the land use that's proposed for it? Let me just put that thought out there.
You don't have
to have an answer now. Just think about it.
Well, what do you mean by
sometimes residential buildings get built in commercial zones, and sometimes commercial buildings get built in residential zones. So if what you're trying to reach is the impact of commercial buildings, then you might want to focus more on the land use rather than the zone.
That's a good point.
Yeah,
I don't know if it, currently the ordinance is written in respect to zones. Is that right, Mike?
Yeah, well, the way the ordinance is written, there's a sort of a requirement of having a substantial impact or an extraordinary impact, whatever the language is. I don't have it right here in front of me. But it applies differently in different zones. In some zoning districts, that impact, if it has that impact, it goes to the Board of Adjustment. In other zoning districts, if it has an impact, it goes to this board. But let me just make one observation, and that is that I think there's occasionally a perception, perhaps not so much on this board, but sometimes in the general public, that if an application comes to this board, it somehow is reviewed under a different set of standards than if it goes to the Board of Adjustment, because this board is elected and the Board of Adjustment is not. That is not accurate. If it is a special use permit or a conditional use permit, it is by nature, as you know, a quasi-judicial matter, and either board would have to decide the matter based upon the evidence. So presumably, if you had the same evidentiary presentation to both boards, you'd get the same result from one board or the other. I mean, you may have a different perspective on it, there can be a number of reasons why, obviously, and there have been reasons why you've chosen to say some permits go to you and some go to the Board of Adjustment. But one would be inaccurate to presuppose or assume that if it comes to you, because this board is elected, that a permit could be turned down just because the neighborhood doesn't like it. It can't be. I mean, if they meet the standards of the ordinance, they get the permit, and if they, subject to the requirements of the ordinance, the Board of Adjustment has the same standards as you do. Obviously, you...
In fair enough, Mike, but also that the way you're describing that presents it as though ultimately for either Board of Adjustment or Board of Aldermen, as though the question was just do we or don't we issue a permit, and it's not quite that simple, because it's do we or don't we issue a permit under X, Y, and Z conditions, and
that's true.
And I'll just say, that. David Collins is a wonderful man. He was not elected to be chair of that board, and so his perspective on the world is not the same as mine. That doesn't mean mine's better than his or his is better than mine, but just
No, there could be perfectly legitimate reasons, and this board would have certain different perspectives than the other board, and there may be good reasons why, for various reasons, you'd want the matter to come to you. But I guess I would try to discourage the perception that I think is implicit, at least in some of the materials that were, some of the most recent memo that was sent to you, that somehow.
Right.
This board has the ability, because it is an elected board, to just turn a project down because the neighborhood is not in favor of it. In other words, it's not purely a matter of show of hands. Who's in favor of it? And if the majority is against the project, irrespective of what the evidence shows, you turn it down. That this board could turn it down where the Board of Adjustment could not. That is not the case.
Right.
Both boards are subject to the same restrictions about basing your decision on based upon evidence. But clearly, and as Meyer points out, you know, you have different perspectives, and the conditions that pursuant to which, if a permit were issued, that you might impose might be very different than the Board of Adjustment. So there can be very good reasons why you'd want it to come to you, but not the Board of Adjustment. But one of them is not that we can turn a project down because we can count hands and the Board of Adjustment cannot. That would
right.
not be
right. right. That's a good point.
So Mike, on Mark's point about determining based on land use, proposed use rather than the zone. Can the ordinance be written that way? Or we'd have to go through the whole table of uses, I guess, or could we do something like he was suggesting in terms of based on a building size? Are those possibilities?
Yes, you could do either one of those, I think. The criteria are varied that you could make a determination as to which way it goes. I would discourage leaving that judgment up to the zoning administrator to decide he could go this way or that way if certain criteria are met. I think that judgment ought to be the board's. In other words, he might make the determination that it's going to have a substantial impact, but I would discourage having an ordinance that said if he finds a substantial impact, then he can choose where to send it. We're already sort of in an area here where this provision is a little unusual, which is to say that that not every ordinance has it, and
right.
So I would discourage providing too much discretion to the zoning administrator to make a determination for an application as to where it goes.
Okay.
But the criteria that you could use are varied. It could be, you know, as Mayor suggests, either the size of the project or the
you could send residential to one board and commercial to a different.
I like the idea of the size. I think that makes a lot of sense. Size matters.
I have heard that.
My quick point was going to be that I do agree with that criteria of you know, size of the building. I mean, I think to all business, I'm not sure how wide that might be or how much it mm-hmm. might, you know, it might draw a larger number than we need to or than is even necessary for the purposes
right.
of
no,
the
I
amendment.
Think that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Michelle.
The land use ordinance, the language you sent us in the staff report about what it currently says, can you just say a little bit, because there are certain zones that are listed in there, and we're talking about either adding B3 to that or having a size requirement that then it gets kicked to CUP or is an SUP, and then who decides on that. Do you, Mike, know or anybody here why these districts were chosen, the downtown ones and obviously the watershed, to be for SUPs, or be helpful for me to?
Not precisely, but I can tell you that when the ordinance was originally drafted, everything went to the Board of Adjustment. I mean, the
okay.
kick upstairs was just to the Board of Adjustment.
And so at one point we changed it because?
At one or more points, I think there may have been a couple of different amendments. And certainly I remember, you know, when at the time the University Lake watershed was put into place, virtually everything in that watershed was a conditional use permit. So to kick it up from a single family house to anything else, the logical place was to go to the Board of Aldermen because everything else was going to the Board of Aldermen. I think the other changes, you can see it has been amended at least three times. Some of the other changes, I think, were in reaction to a concern that similar to what we have here, where
right.
there was a feeling that a project was controversial and probably would have been differently handled or better handled or should have been handled by the Board of Aldermen, and so it was changed for that reason. Exactly what the project was, I can't tell you. I don't recall.
That's fine. I just wanted to know that it's not like I mean, it seems like we've been reactive in the past when there's been something similar to this, and we've changed the land use ordinance as a result of that.
That's accurate.
And also from sitting through the liaison to the Board of Adjustment, I don't know if our process, I know it's quasi-judicial if we were to vote on that. I don't know if we have the same time. They had no time limits on the developer, nor the public. And we do, I assume we do have time limits in a quasi-judicial, or do we not? I haven't sat through one.
No.
There's no set rules on that. Now, this board has, and more recently has established some time limits. I think the mayor has a little timer and a thing there, and those have been generally enforced, certainly to a far greater degree. I mean, the Board of Adjustment took the position that they were not going to impose those time limits, and that of course is, I mean, one of the considerations in where these matters go is I think, and I'm just sort of supposing, that the Board of Adjustment felt like this is all we have to do on our agenda, you know, so if it goes one meeting or two meetings or three meetings, so be it, whereas the Board of Aldermen obviously
are not,
this is not
that.
The only thing that you're dealing with,
right.
So I mean, certainly some places impose very strict limitations on the time frames within which these things can be presented. But that's one factor in having the Board of Adjustment rather than you handle some permits, is because they have more time to deal with it than you do.
That's true.
So.
Yeah, the last thing I want to say is that I think there is a difference in that we're policymakers, and so we're having a discussion now about changing the land use ordinance that the Board of Adjustment would never have in this process. And I do think it's not that we would vote on it any different than they did. They did a great job, I feel like. But I feel like we are policymakers and they're not. So I just think I want to name that difference.
Yes.
Not that it would change the decision, but there is an implication given that we're having this discussion now as a result of what they voted on last week.
Yes.
They're not separate. I'm done.
Tammy, Jackie, Dan.
And I think to that point, I mean, fortunately, I feel that the Board of Adjustment, both in their quasi-judicial function, but also in how that decision aligned with what the community wanted, was the right decision. So we're not reacting to something that was wrongly done and we think really needs a huge fix. But to this point of the luxury of time and how much the community was really able to express itself during that process, I thought was a luxury given the other processes we've been in and the time constraints we've had. And for that reason, I just want to put that question or highlight or underscore it, that there is a distinctive difference between those quasi-judicial opportunities that the Board of Adjustment has and the time they have to really hear both sides thoroughly and give the public a time to really research enough to come back with really cogent and valuable arguments that are convincing. So it's not so obvious to say this should automatically always go to the Board of Aldermen. I thought it was a positive, valuable attribute of what the process was.
So, Jackie.
I would like us to have further discussion on this, particularly when things get kicked where. And one reason that I think this is an important conversation and that I would like for there to be some really quantitative guidelines, such as Chapel Hill does, is I do not like putting staff in the position of guessing, mm-hmm. you know, because when a decision is unpopular, I think we should be the ones to take the heat for it. And I know there have been times when staff has made decisions based on the ordinance as it now stands. People were unhappy with that decision, and staff ended up taking heat for mm-hmm. for that. And that's just not a conscionable position. Yeah, if we're going to call ourselves a progressive community, then the positions we put staff in has to be looked at very, very carefully. I see some nodding over there. So when we have that discussion, I really would want some quantitative guidelines for staff, just for to be fair.
Okay. So, I have a comment. Yeah, I have a comment and a question. So my comment is that, so in my 6.5 years on the board, this has never happened before, that there was ever a question about something going to the Board of Adjustment. And when I met with Trish and Marty on Friday, I asked them, well, does this happen very often in your experience? And they had to really think about it, and I think you went way back into the 80s, if I understood properly, to come up with an issue that happened with something that happened at Wendy's, which I sure don't remember. So I think, you know, part of my comment is that, we want to be careful we're not solving a problem that doesn't really exist or that ultimately can't be solved because, for example, let's say we establish a 25,000 square foot threshold like Chapel Hill has, and you've probably experienced this in Chapel Hill, where then the building comes in that's 22,000 square feet and the neighbors can't stand it.
Two of them at 24,900 side by side.
Oh, I remember that.
On West Franklin Street, yeah.
I remember that very well, actually. Yeah, exactly. That comes up, and so you have this, you're back at square one again. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm necessarily drawing a conclusion there, but I think we want to be clear about if what the problem is we want to solve, if any, and what a solution is that's going to work. And I don't know that we have clarity on either at this point.
I think you're right about that. So I think this might be in the category of we need to do a little more thinking and bring it back up with the staff when we're ready.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Dan. 605 went to the Board of Adjustment, 605 Main, and that was 2004, 2003. So it didn't go back to 1988.
Okay.
Well, that wasn't a kick up to the CUP level. That was already a CUP by
SUP
by standard ordinance.
And I wanted to ask about the SUPs and the CUPs. One of the things that there's a difference in how many feet of notification between SUPs and CUPs, and I would like to see that both are 1,000 feet because I think it's the CUP? CUP
is more
1,000.
Yeah, the SUP is 500. Yeah. Right, and so the SUP is the one that can potentially go to the Board of Adjustment, and so I think that needs to be expanded to 1,000 feet. Mm-hmm. And in addition, the question about community input and petitioning is where would we be if the community wanted to do petition?
Mike, do you want to speak?
I don't think you can do that. I think that would be extremely problematic to, in essence, have the decision as to whether or not the project required one level of permit or another be a function of what the neighbors or the popular
actually, my suggestion was not that that would necessitate it, but that would bring it up before us to decide if we agreed. I agree, though, that I don't think that really is the way to go.
And one, Marty, I just want to come behind a great question that Michelle asked about the ephemeral stream. So when you finally make a determination on that ephemeral stream, whether it be ephemeral or not, will that be a final determination that will be irrefutable, or is that going to be something that will be up for discussion at some other point?
At some point, the staff will make what I would call a final determination about the request before us. I would just reserve or as a caveat say that it is conceivable as they brought something before us late this time that they could bring something else, a different idea, if you will, and we'd have to make a decision about that one as well. But we will make a decision about this specific question before us at some point. That could be, Mike, I believe, appealed as any other decision could be appealed.
To the Board of Adjustment, depending upon if it At some point it could be. I would have to look at exactly whether or not that's a decision that's appealable. But at some point that may be appealable to the Board of Adjustment as well. Maybe. We'd have to look at that. It depends exactly what the question is and what the answer is, frankly.
Mark, can I make a motion? I'd like to move attachment A, accepting the report with the additional stipulation that we have already kind of via email asked staff to respond to the letter we received from the Alabama Avenue neighbors, and that at the same time they give us that report, that they already also provide whatever response they might have to our discussion tonight, to the extent that they feel clarity in their ability to do so.
I just have a question about whether I brought up mediation and I asked a question about that, and would that relate to the next steps on this resolution or not? Do we need to vote on this and then I can
ask? I absolutely accept that as a friendly amendment.
Okay. Can I say something about my suggestion for
sure,
what that
please.
Is? Okay. So it's my question was about Vision 2020 and saying that basically it says that we should develop a mediation policy, and our current policy is that we encourage a neighborhood meeting, from what I understand from what you
yes.
told me, and that the real response was that we there wasn't an issue with recommending it be a facilitated mediation or facilitated neighborhood meeting.
Right.
And that's happened in the past.
We used to do that an awful lot, and it was very effective. And then we had some board members who are now gone who didn't like that very much. So this is a good time, I think, to bring that back. It was very effective.
Did they volunteer, or did they pay? I mean, how does that happen?
It was usually Andy Sachs, and it was because Andy has a background in both city and regional planning and in mediation.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be over the course of, depending on the size of it, it would, you know, he'd first meet with a small group to figure out, you know, that included officials, to figure out what the issue was and how to frame it and how to get the group working on it. And then there would be as large as you want it, people coming to a Saturday or an evening or two Saturdays to kind of hash things out in a very deliberative way. A big example is that's how we got the facilitated small area plan, and that happened over many months.
Mm-hmm.
It started with Lake Hogan Farms. Lake Hogan Farms would be very, very, very different if it hadn't been for the mediation process. And that was the first one. That's when we started doing that, and it was pretty effective. And we've also used mediation for things like coming up with parks plans at one point. So it's bringing in a disinterested facilitator, with the basic idea being that public hearings don't always work that well because everybody's so gung-ho to get their idea out, and they only have 3 minutes, and there's no time for, hey, I changed my mind, that makes sense, or if we put these two together, it just creates a whole different atmosphere than the combative winner-take-all kind of thing that public hearings encouraged, not only on the part of the citizens, but on our part as well, quite honestly. So
did we build that into the fee system, or
yeah,
did we absorb that? Like, did we absorb that?
Cost
did the town
wise.
Absorb that? Or
yes,
did we build it into the fee system? The town absorbed it.
It's really not that expensive, and it took less time, and you get
right,
better
right,
solutions
right.
that, and you get more. This is Michelle's word that I really like. You get more intentional solutions that way, you know.
Yeah,
so,
there,
yeah.
Well, I talked to Evan in the same building as Deschutes Settlement Center, and I asked them about bringing this up tonight. I didn't want to say their name without asking them. But they are interested. I mean, they're willing to do this if they've done it in the past.
Yeah.
And so if the staff could follow up with them or however that needs to happen on what contracting with them would look like for a developer to have a facilitated just neighborhood meeting or discussion.
Okay. So I take it y'all are going to vote for the motion.
This is the social workers' caucus.
The social workers are in favor of the motion.
We are.
Let's hear from everybody else. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed.
Better pass it unanimously.
I just had one more question. Mark, can I ask a question on the femoral stream?
There's like four or five of us.
Hey, Marty, Trish, this question of the femoral stream, is that, so it sounds like it's an administrative decision. It's not like a map amendment that where we show what are femoral streams on our maps. And is that an accurate understanding?
Well, our GIS establishes kind of a presumptive or approximation of the drainage basins. And then survey work actually is where you get down to, I guess, the nitty-gritty of it. And ultimately, what we're reviewing and will be reviewing is survey work and suggestions about precisely on the ground with the lay of the land and the topography where one drainage basin begins and another ends. That is not to say that it's as simple as if the drainage basin starts here, then it's not 5 acres. I mean, this is a bit more complicated than that because part of the water is going through a pipe, the part that they're suggesting is coming from a different drainage basin. So the question ultimately is, are they able to continue it within a pipe?
Isn't it determined by the drainage basin area and not necessarily the water that's actually coming from wherever?
Yes, that's the nuance of all that with respect to what the ordinance says is what we're needing to work through here. Usually, it's clear cut. You know, it's well over 5 acres. This one is, any way you look at it, this one is right on the cusp of 5 acres.
That's why it's complicated. Okay, got it. Thanks.
I don't know if I really answered that. But,
no, it's on the border.
All right. I would like to, if we're done with this agenda item, I would like to suggest that we take a 3-minute recess and then come back and pick up on A3 regarding GigU and high-speed internet.
like.
Agenda item A3, informational update on NCDOT fiber optic project and GIGU.
I'm here. Tonight we wanted to try to give you an overview of a lot of pieces that are happening that are sort of coming together. The universe is bringing them all together at once. And there's, I guess, why I'm standing here talking about it, because there's a lot of economic development implications associated with it. There's social equity and digital divide issues associated with it. There's a lot of moving parts associated with the fact that the town, and I'm just going to give you sort of the overview of what's going on. And as a layperson, and maybe I can put it in lay terms, and then we have technical people come up and talk about it, and then maybe we can talk about it in lay terms. Yeah, because there's a lot associated with it. But the town has been in the process for several years, along with also Chapel Hill's doing the same thing. Had an opportunity to implement a fiber optic system. Put fiber in the ground to create an opportunity for really fast internet. And so all the ways that you can use that internet are the things that we're going to be talking about tonight. And in parallel with that, there is this effort being called GIGU, which is a coalition of about 42 universities across the country that are collectively trying to raise awareness and conceptually come together to have high-speed internet surrounding universities so that they can deliver services in terms of and be a leader in the world in terms of research and attracting teachers. And I mean, that's where the industry's going, and so we need to keep up that way as a country. The other thing that is happening is that there is private industry out there that sees these opportunities arising, and that's where the GIGU squared comes in as a private company that has put out a proposal and raised capital, potential capital, $200 million in capital, to and put out sort of an RFP of their own for communities to say, and there would be 5 to 6 communities that will be selected, to say, how could we innovatively partner together to create these internet pockets of ultra-fast, super-fast internet that folks are interested in. So there's all these things happening. It's what we already have as an infrastructure. It's what the universities across the country and coincidentally UNC, NC State, and Duke are forming a more of a regional coalition and consortium to work together, again, as RTP, to be a part of that. And then what private industry is out there doing and wants to do and to be a part of what's going on. And so how do we want to participate? At what rate do we want to participate? How do we want to focus the asset that we have? And, you know, do we want to be a part of the Giga Squared proposal that's happening now, or do we just want to step back and do a separate RFP for proposals and see what companies, private industry, could do for us? If you think about the fiber optics as a utility, you know, similar to other utilities that communities have, water, sewer, those kind of things, we have a sort of another layer here in the state of North Carolina. Local governments have been restricted that we can't compete with cable companies and all those kind of things for providing this. So we have to have sort of some sort of internet provider service. So there's, you know, how to structure all those things. And so tonight we have Andy Vogel, our own IT director, who's going to come up and talk about what the town's doing in terms of the fiber optic, where we are, with maps, and he's got a couple slides. He'll talk about that. I also will like to introduce Larry Conrad, who is the Vice Chancellor of IT and the CIO for the university, and his associate, Terry Buckner, who will come up, and they'll talk about GIGU, and they'll also talk about sort of these two funding paths that we might want to think about, and the megabit squared, which is, again, the private company that is saying, hey, folks, we have money to invest. Tell us how we can partner with you to do that. Or, and do we want to do that, and what some of the other communities are doing in the region on that. Or do we want to step back and do our own RFP at some point you know, exactly how do we want to use the asset. So this is multifaceted. It's taken me weeks to get my brain around it, and I'm still working on it. So with that, I'll ask Andy to come up and talk about the fiber.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay, so as Annette was saying, thanks to the NCDOT U4704's traffic signal upgrade project, we now have a bunch of fiber around Carver. The project is nearing completion this summer of 2012. That's this summer. The fiber is actually in place and functional right now. The town's fiber, that is. The project was installed with this project, and it's owned by the town, and that's what's important for us to understand. It's our fiber. This fiber currently connects Town Hall, the Century Center, Fire Station 2, and goes down East Main Street to Merritt Mill Road. It's been installed at a greatly reduced cost thanks to this project. It provides a huge capacity in terms of fiber, in terms of the actual bandwidth you can do with fiber, and in terms of the fiber count. These are 144 fiber count cables. Also, there's great potential intergovernmental use, such as interlinking emergency services, GIS, reduced internet connectivity costs, basically possibly make use of NC-REN, of NC-NC, and also there's cable path redundancy. That is that we, in terms of that, in cable path redundancy, we have a set of fiber. Chapel Hill has a set of fiber. If we can connect those fibers potentially in the future, that would give us the emergency services benefits, the GIS benefits, reduce internet connectivity cost benefits. It would give us a cable redundancy benefit. That way, if one side of ours broke, we could just go around the other side of the loop. Basically, we have formed a loop. And that brings us to the next slide. This is the fiber that we're talking about. This is how our fiber looks. You can see that the red line represents the fiber. In most places, it's 144 account fiber. And that is pretty much it. And the important things to take away from this, well, once again, we own that fiber. We can do with it what we want. That fiber cable has lots of fiber inside of it. Not all of it has to be used for one purpose. The town may only use up to 10 fibers in that fiber, in 144 count fiber. The other fiber could be split up among many different uses, whatever you guys would choose.
Oh, well, it looks like Weaver Street Reconstruction, we did run fiber.
Yes. Yeah. Well. Yes. Yes. There is fiber running along there from a previous project and from this project. And then you were asking also at that time period about getting interducts across or ductwork across the road, and we did that also during that project. Yes, George Public Works took care of that, and that worked out really well. We have about three different pull boxes in place along there.
So does Chapel Hill have fiber that comes anywhere close to us?
Comes very close. Comes very close at Fire Station 2. Comes very close. Right here, where this is where the Jiffy Lube is, if you're familiar with that area there by Merritt Road, and then comes down here. This is Public Works down here. And to give you a little more perspective, this is McDougal in our Fire Station 2. And this is Calvander out here.
That's good.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. And how much, what is this, you know, capitalism is king, and we own the capital here, so...
How do we ism?
What does this represent? And
okay,
because when we're talking about partnering with folks, we got to know what we have.
Absolutely. What it represents is, once again, huge bandwidth between locations, a backbone that other fibers could be taken off to, brought to the home to distribute services, could be brought to business parks. That is something that I think is part of economic and community development to kind of figure out along with the ESC.
So there's an actual monetary cost?
To this project, that's the nice thing about this. Right now, we have connectivity from Town Hall to Fire Station 2 through lease lines. After doing this, we won't need those lease lines anymore. Those money savings we're doing from removing those lease lines will pay for this project in about 8 to 10 years. And so it was a really good decision. And then at the same time, pulling a 144-count fiber cable versus a 20-count fiber cable for us, that cost was greatly reduced because we did it as part of this project. They bought it with the bulk fiber they're buying for their project with what Chapel Hill bought. So it kind of worked out really well.
So
great cost savings.
Millions, like what is it, millions, or what does this represent?
This represents about $200,000. Right now it's coming in about $150,000.
And before we leased lines through typical broadband, existing broadband
absolutely.
Networks.
Dark fiber from Time Warner, right. Costing us around $1,600 for this connection here, about $1,600 a month.
Right.
Okay. And now we don't need it any longer.
Andy, I had a question as to whether or not having that kind of bandwidth is something that, as an asset to the town of Carrboro, that's something that can be monetized in some way?
Sure it could be.
I mean, is that looking into the future? I'm just wondering, yes, is that what's implied here?
I think that's sort of the question, yeah.
I mean,
yeah. And I think that's exactly what Annette's trying to discover, that she'll be talking to the community, talking to you folks about, and trying to figure out what direction you want to take this.
But we don't, I mean, okay. But it just seems like this is not a decision that can be made quickly because this is really based on innovations yet to come.
Absolutely. This technology, you're looking out, you could possibly be looking out 30 years
right.
with what this could supply. You're right. This is not a short-term technology at all. We've had fiber in. Our first fiber project was done in around 99, 2000. The technology hasn't changed. We just keep putting different electronic equipment on the end of it, get higher and higher bandwidth. That's what happens with fiber. The technology pretty much is the same. Mm-hmm. It's just glass.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
I guess one question.
Well, we have a couple.
Oh,
did you have a question for Andy?
Just related to the $16,000 that we're now saving a month.
$1,600.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Well, still. Well, just wondering. Well, it's not as significant, I guess. But I was wondering if we're taking advantage of those savings to augment what we could build off of this. In other words, if we were to take the $1,600. And to put it into a fund to further develop whatever else we need to in this.
That could definitely be a possibility. Mm-hmm. You know, with towns, it's always interesting because there's always changing dynamics with the town. One thing that we're looking at is our police department. We currently have our own switch. We're looking to move it to Orange County. It helps us we can gather more statistics, know more about our calls and the like. We would need connectivity back to them. Now, potentially, we could do that if we join fiber with Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill already has a connection with Orange County and OCC, Orange County Central. So we could do it through them, potentially. Or if not, we may have to we go away with this one, but we have to pick up another one to go there.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so that's an idea of the asset that we have, and Mr. Conrad would like to
come on up.
Good evening. My name is Larry Conrad, the Vice Chancellor for IT and the Chief Information Officer at UNC Chapel Hill. So, Mr. Mayor, Council, appreciate the opportunity to spend a few minutes talking about this gig.u initiative. I'm not going to try to do any kind of a PowerPoint. I've got, probably 60 slides somewhere I could do on this. But I thought I'd just talk through the background. This whole thing came up a little over a year ago. At least for me, in which I had a call from a colleague at Case Western University who said, have you heard anything about this guy who is trying to get major research universities across the country interested in trying to basically get the high-speed internet into the immediate vicinity surrounding the campus? I said, no, and that was my introduction. And he introduced me to this guy named Blair Levin. Blair is a former deputy. Former deputy of the FCC, and he was the primary author for the Broadband America report that was done a couple of years ago. Basically, Broadband America said essentially the United States needs to get serious about getting pervasive high-speed internet connectivity if we're going to have a chance at retaining our global technological advantage. And let me just take a little of a side because something came out about a week and a half ago. Cisco, of course, has a huge presence in RTP, but their equipment powers much of the worldwide internet. So when Cisco says something about the internet, people tend to listen. A couple of weeks ago, they put out some updated stats that certainly got my attention. And what they said was, and their predictions are 4 years away, 2016, which doesn't seem very far. And they're predicting by 2016, the average number of connected devices worldwide will be 2.5. Every single person on the planet will have an average of 2.5 devices connected to the worldwide internet. That was awesome to me. They said at that point, they still won't have the entire planet connected, but they will be approaching the halfway point. They're predicting 45% of the entire world's population will be connected to the internet. And the average connectivity for that worldwide population, not just U.S., will be around 30, a little over 30 megabits. So average, mediocre, nothing special in 4 years is going to be a little over 30 megabits. Now, if that doesn't underscore, at least in my mind, that really underscores the Broadband America imperative. Because if right today, I think what most people are finding is maybe they've got 5 to 10 megabits per second. And sort of the leading edge that's available is 30 to 50. So, if we're going to get serious about trying to be competitive worldwide, and we'll bring it back to Carbaryl in a moment, but, we've really got to take this on. So where that ended up is, as Annette pointed out, is eventually 42 leading edge research universities like UNC Chapel Hill, like Wake Forest, like Duke, like NC State here in Carolina, all signed up to this. And the basic idea is, how do we incent the private sector to build out these kinds of networks? And we're approaching it as sort of a test bed approach. I mean, if the private sector was going to do this sort of all by itself, it would have happened. We've talked to the major incumbents, and what they've told us is, look, we've done our focus groups, and we don't have pervasive demand for, say, gigabit connectivity to the home. There doesn't appear to be any immediate move in that direction. But the rationale behind trying to pursue the research universities was that most of the major initiatives, certainly the internet initiatives, that have happened have come out of research university settings, including the web itself. That was an invention of research university. Netscape, for those of you who remember it, Facebook, Google, all those came from research university settings. And the basic thinking is that the next big thing, whatever it will be, is going to come out of one of those major university settings. And I know personally from my involvement with very high-speed networks, leading-edge high-speed networks over the last decade plus, when you take very smart, motivated, capable people, you give them incredible connectivity. They do really interesting things. They come up with ways to use the network and to use that connectivity that you couldn't even imagine. And that's really the thrust that's behind all this, is that, if we can put that kind of capability in the hands of at least the immediate surrounding areas of the universities, we've got a great shot at being the home, if you will, or at least to leverage that to the next big thing. Okay, so where do we sit on this right now? The organization is a national organization. It's led by this Blair Levin. The group did an RFI last summer into the fall and winter. We got about 50 responses from companies across the country. It's a whole spectrum. We have the traditional providers who are definitely interested and are at the table, and we're talking with them. We also found some non-traditional providers. One of them was this Gigabit Squared that Annette mentioned, which I'll come back to in a moment. But we found a spectrum of possibilities, people who wanted to come in and build an open network where we'll build a network and basically sell services to anybody who comes along. We found some people who wanted to come in and put fiber through our sewers. These just really creative ideas, things I wouldn't have thought of, or some new wireless capabilities. So we're looking at all that. And since Duke and NC State and Carolina are all in this thing, one of the things that we've talked to each other from the beginning is, can we leverage the cachet, if you will, of the triangle? And we think there's a real possibility of that. People want to be here. There is that sense that if there's something new and innovative, a place like like the triangles, where that could come from. So we have a local planning team that we've formed, and Andy's part of that, and we're working with Chapel Hill as well as the university on this. And we're looking at sort of the from a couple different ways. You know, what would the immediate opportunity be? And we want to take a long, hard look at this gigabit squared opportunity, but we also want to look at the opportunity of issuing a separate RFP, if that's something that, of course, that the councils would have to agree to and the town managers would have to support, but if that made sense. And would there be some way to maybe do that as a set of triangle, not only universities, but the related communities? So that's we're still looking at this. It's still data gathering mode. We're trying to figure out where all the fiber are, where the fiber are in each community. The fiber is definitely an asset. This is something that that can be monetized, we think, in some significant way, and is something that is of definite interest to these vendors that we're talking to. The goals that we're trying to get to, as I say, is trying to incent private investment to build these multiple test beds. And again, we're calling them test beds at this point, only from the standpoint of we think it's likely that you're not going to get somebody who's going to come in and just bam, do everybody, everywhere. But what we think is likely is we can find some clusters of activities, and that's why it's important to know where the fiber goes, because it might be some combination of businesses, it might be apartment complexes, right? Might be individual homeowners, it could be clinics, it could be schools. We have to take a look at where the potential interest in using this this might be, and let's see. Next steps, as I say, we're trying to understand where that potential usage is. We're working on a survey instrument right now. We think that there's there'd be great value from surveying. Certainly the businesses, because there's definitely an economic development opportunity here. But we're also trying to gain some sense for where are the major apartment complexes. For example, gaming is huge amongst college students as well as a lot of younger adults. So gamers can take advantage of this type of capability. So these are the things we're trying to wrap our minds around. Okay, in the background, we're also aware of the House Bill 129, the level of playing field bill that passed, and we've been talking to legal representation to make sure that everything we're talking about fits within that. We have those assurances that if a city or a municipality wanted to go out and launch the service directly, yes, that's a problem. But there is no problem in bidding out an opportunity so that multiple players can take a look at it. So we're working within that context. Okay, so finally, I guess the last thing I'd like to say is come back to that, 2.5 devices per inhabitant of the planet Earth, and that if we're going to prepare our communities for the future, if we're going to be prepared to compete against that kind of a populace and that kind of a wired populace worldwide, we've got to do something better than just mediocre connectivity. And that's, I think, what's driving myself and my colleagues around the country, is how can we help our communities get to that point? Any questions?
I don't know if I have a question so much as just a comment. I mean, I think the things you're talking about are very exciting in terms of, and certainly we were excited by the possibility of Google Fiber, for example, having considered the Chapel Hill Carborough area. And in some ways this is, fundamentally similar. I guess the reservation that I have, I think most folks on this board have, about all of this is that it seems like where it's all headed is that we're going to get internet access that's six times better, and that hopefully only costs like a small percentage more than what we're paying now, and that'll get all those of us who are connected now connected a lot better. But I don't see how it connects anybody who's not connected now. Well, you see what I'm saying?
Sure. Yeah, that
and that's to me, that's the biggest issue.
Like one of the biggest issues in the world,
really. So I'm wondering whether there is a way, and particularly in the context of that we've invested hundreds of thousands of dollars or whatever it is in government funds in creating the infrastructure that we're talking about leasing out or contracting out or whatever. You know, my question is, how do we use that asset, not just a return for the municipal corporation that is the town of Carrboro, but for the people of Carrboro, for the taxpayers of Carrboro,
right,
residents of our community as a whole. And, you know, I think part of that return needs to be that we're getting internet into Abbey Court, that we're getting internet into Lloyd Street or Estes mm-hmm. Park or Royal Park or wherever, in ways that we're not doing right now. And I just would cite as an example, I ran into a friend who lives over at Abbey Court and asked him in Spanish whether the Human Rights Center's Wi-Fi system that they were running out of their little apartment on a shoestring was something that he was able to take advantage of at his apartment. And he said, how should I know?
Hmm.
Does the Wi-Fi signal reach me? How on earth would I know? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, there's reality for hundreds, mm-hmm. just at Abbey Court, hundreds mm-hmm. of families in Carrboro. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, not to get too up on the high horse too much here, but just to say, I got no problem with generally where we're headed with this whole conversation, but I'm saying how do we make it?
Sure.
How do we make it our own? You know, how do we make it Carrboro?
Sure. So I guess my reaction to that would be that's great, and it's and I think it's one of the real strengths of the RFP approach, because each city can establish their own priorities. You know, for instance, Chapel Hill has a similar need as well. They've got some wireless capabilities, and but unfortunately, they're almost unusable because they don't have the bandwidth to properly service it. So, I think that's an argument for doing the RFP and establishing, you know, what the rules of engagement are. Mm-hmm. And I say we're looking at this gigabit squared initiative. They're sort of the opposite, where they've issued the RFP and they're looking for cities to respond. We're looking at that. The planning team is going to discuss this again. We've had one meeting last week or a couple of weeks ago. We'll have another one at the end of this week. And what we're trying to sort out is whether we think that that's the route that will go. I mean, their $200 million of capitalization certainly has everybody's attention, but is that going to deliver the kind of pricing and the kind of competitiveness that we want to see in a free marketplace? And that's what we're trying to sort wrap our minds around. I mean, this is still a what-if. We'll be very clear about that. We don't have any, you know, absolutes here, but we're getting a lot closer as each month goes by or week goes by, where we're really wrapping our minds around what are the capabilities that exist, what are the opportunities, what kind of uses. I mean, telehealth is one of the areas because of, you know, obviously a place like Duke or UNC Chapel Hill, where healthcare is such a huge piece. That's something we're looking very hard at. Aging in place opportunities, those were certainly some new options. When we talked to the Medicaid folks, you know, if we could find ways to, you know, just pick one simple example, if you could find a way to keep elderly Medicaid recipients in their homes, for 6 months longer, it's billions of dollars nationally. Hmm. That you can just, so, I mean, you know, there's a lot at stake by thinking outside the box and trying to leverage the kind of capability we're talking about.
Industry.
Okay. Anything else?
An interesting point, that last one in particular.
Well, it's very intriguing. We're trying to look at all of those kinds of use cases, because, again, that's one where, you know, I mean, everybody wins. You not only improve the quality of health care, but you drive down the cost of health care.
And you might even drive up the quality of somebody's life.
You might. You might. All right.
Hopefully. Okay. Thank you very much for
thank
the
you.
Presentation.
Thank you.
Dan.
Yeah, I want to make a comment. Doesn't really pertain to any of the presentation, which is why I wanted to wait. But, and I don't really want to put a damper on things, because I think if people are going to be connected, it's nice to be connected quickly in a way that's easy to use and all that sort of stuff. But I'm not excited about the prospect of 2.5 connected devices per person. I think the idea of human relationships being increasingly mediated through the web and through electronic devices has implications for human society, human community, human subjectivity that we don't understand, that we can't take the time to understand, because these kinds of developments are driven by capital formation and profit maximization, and not by trying to figure out primarily what will bring human well-being. And certainly as we're doing it, you know, we hear great things that can occur from it in terms of improvements in healthcare and improvements in education or whatever that might be. But I don't really have a specific point in terms of policy with this, but I think it's prudent for us all to be thoughtful about what kind of society we're creating. And I'll just give one example from my own life, which is that I'm not a gamer myself because it doesn't appeal to me. I actually like going and having coffee with people and talking to them as my social time. My son is becoming a gamer, and he meets his friends from school inside a game. And when I say to him, well, wouldn't you like to go over to Mike's house and play? He's like, no, we play in the game. We don't need to see each other. And I think, you know, and I'm troubled by that. I don't think that's the best way for him to be growing up, and I'm the parent, so I can do something about it. But I think that's just one tiny micro example of something that's happening in a multitude of ways across our society, and we are changing ourselves. And, you know, I think in a town like Harborough is a place where we can be more thoughtful about it.
Thanks, Dan.
I wonder if I could ask the Board of Aldermen's indulgence. We, I don't know whether all of us have received, but I have for sure, a letter from Brian Russell about this particular initiative, and I would, he is so extremely more knowledgeable about this topic than I am that I would really like for him to share what the comments that he was trying to get at in the letter, if you would. Is that all right? Is that acceptable?
Yeah,
we'll,
please.
We'll wrap up.
Thank you. I'm also a member of the Economic Sustainability Commission. My name is Brian Russell, and I just wanted to point out a few things. One, that obviously this fiber is an extremely valuable resource that you can sell. And by what I mean by that is I wanted to point out that on March 19th, an attorney from D.C. named Cynthia Pohl spoke to the Chapel Hill Town Council and told them about this law that does prevent you from creating a utility from selling broadband. It does not prohibit you from selling access to the fiber to any party you wish. You have quite a large amount of resource. The 104-to-1 fibers, that is a lot of different groups, potentially a lot of different things, and you should keep that in mind. Nor does it prevent you from giving away broadband across your network. And you can buy it cheap, as Andy mentioned, and you can give it away. There's no law preventing you that. And the people who wrote the law that passed were, in part, the telcos. And I'm familiar with the attorneys that wrote it for them. And the reason why they open up that loophole is so you can sell it to them. So, you know, that resource to them, that backbone resource that our tax dollars paid for and put in the ground. So it's just really important that you know that. So when you're thinking about decisions and who you want to partner with and how you want to go about this, that you do have some legal recourse to earn money and to bridge the digital divide, which is the most important thing. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Brian.
Okay.
Mark.
Yes, ma'am. Oh, come on.
Mm-mm.
wanted to just do a couple of little broadband 101 kind of issues. So we've got fiber. Some of it's in the ground. Some of it's on poles. It's around. But there's 144 pairs of them. The whole university runs on four pairs. So that's still 140 pairs left. To create a municipal network just for Carrboro business, you know, between here and the fire station emergency services, you might need another four. So now you're down to, you've still got 136 that you can make money off of or you can give away. So the law does allow you to give it away. The town could choose to create a broadband wireless network that would get out to I don't remember the current name, the old Ten Top neighborhood. I don't remember the current name for it. and the Northside area in conjunction with the town of Chapel Hill. Town of Chapel Hill's already said their top priority is putting high-speed connectivity into their public housing facilities. Mm-hmm. And they actually manage the housing facility that's over off of North Greensboro mm-hmm. here in Carrboro. So there's lots of opportunities here. And what we're trying to do is get everybody together who has a voice and say, what are all of these different opportunities and how do we do this? So from an economic development perspective, the high-tech companies here in Carrboro and in Chapel Hill are paying $1,400, $1,500 a month for network access. If we can bring that down to $800 or $900 a month or even lower, with faster access, they're more productive, they're making more money, and they're more likely to stay in town. So there's that economic development opportunity. It's also going to bring more businesses in here, because if they say, you've got this, I talked to D.R. Bryan just yesterday over at Southern Village, and he's got a company coming in that this is a selling point. They want to know, where's the fiber, and can it connect? And when is it going to be ready? Is it going to be ready, and can we connect to it? You know, they're not even asking for the town to connect them. They will do it themselves. It's that valuable. So there's lots of opportunities here, and I think that's what we're asking for tonight is your approval to go forward and explore these opportunities and bring that back to you in the fall. And I think Annette's going to deal with that, but it's exciting, you know. There's all of the healthcare opportunities. There's new technologies being developed at MIT that helps people remember to take their medicines so they can stay at home. So it's a scale and it's connected to a camera. And if you don't take your pills on time, somebody's going to call you and look at you and say, "Have you taken your meds?" So it's creating connectivity in a really positive way. So, thank you. I don't mean to sound too much like a missionary here, but it's exciting to me.
I think the controls are huge. So, thank you, Terry. I wanted to just kind of make. I totally agree with the point you're making. Absolutely understand it about computer gaming. Believe me, I got some guys who were too into it as well. But I also want to point out, I don't know if anybody saw this, but about 6 months ago it hit the headlines that a researcher at the University of Washington who was trying to solve a extremely difficult chemistry problem involving protein structures in the AIDS virus had been struggling for literally over a decade with a particular problem and came up with the idea of turning it into a computer game, which he did, and he posted online and recruited about 500,000 people who took about 3 weeks to solve the problem.
Wow.
So, you know, just to say, who knows what the power of computer gaming might actually be.
Collaborative learning.
All right. Is there anything else?
Do you need to know if we are saying we want an RFP to be pursued or not?
Right.
One path is this is a lot of information and you all just need to ponder it more. You know, maybe there's really nothing tonight other than information. If there's anything pressing, it is this megabyte squared gigabyte square RFP opportunity, and do we want to participate in that? Because the deadline for that is July 31st, that a proposal would have to be.
Help me out, because I think if I understood it, it's a question of whether we're responding to sort of their RFP or we're issuing our own RFP.
Correct. Yeah, that's right. So if we're responding to theirs, right, there's a July 31st date associated with that. So that's in terms of any deadlines. You know, just some direction, how, you know, passionate or important do we feel like it is to do that? It seems like Raleigh and Durham are pursuing that and have sort of identified their service areas that they really want to concentrate on. Exactly who, and I'm hearing from the university, they would be sort of leading the charge with writing any kind of proposal, so they would be doing that. But do we want to say Carver is participating? Do we? I don't know that we know Chapel Hill is participating.
No, we don't.
Do we? We don't know that yet. I mean, that's that. In terms of anything pressing, otherwise, everything is. I think there's time for just to think about it, absorb. But again, you know, I've been talking about it for weeks, and I'm still wrapping my brain around it too. So, just any direction, thoughts that you all have on that? Is there anything else?
Seems like if we were able to issue, I don't know, half of what we just heard. I'm just going to be clear about that. I got lost. But it seems, I did hear that it seems like if we issued our own, we could tailor what we wanted and respond to the digital divide question or concern that was brought up.
Yes.
And is that correct?
I agree with that.
So if that's correct, I would prefer to do that because we get to tailor it. Again, very limited in my knowledge about this.
And I think that's where RFP does include.
Where you get to say what you want.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, conversely, that we could do that through the gigabit squared.
But what's the cost?
But it's just the time frame, the timing of it, and the staff time, and, you know, just it's kind of a lot in a short period of time.
It is. I've been very concerned lately with the privatization of public goods or large corporations making money off of what small taxpayers have paid for. And that's not just lefty. That's not just lefty paranoia. We're seeing that happening. We're seeing it happening around the country. And so my reticence is just that I want to make sure that the taxpayers of Carborough have not built something that somebody's going to come in and go, hey, we got this money to throw at it. But it's really kind of a smoke and mirrors, and we could end up with the citizens of Carborough kind of handing over this very, very valuable asset. And I don't know that that's the case, but I don't know that it's not the case either, because there is this huge movement to take over our schools, our parks, our highways, our internet service after we pay for it, because God knows we don't want to be socialist, so we can use. So anyway, my reticence is there, and I think maybe the idea of our putting out an RFP, and the RFP would include getting access to our underserved communities, and more than just getting the access to them, but getting the equipment that they would need to take advantage of the access to. Maybe we have a very valuable leverage tool here that we can use for more than just making money.
Annette, maybe, and I'm not clear about how this process works, but were we to pursue our own RFP, you know, one of the things that I think, first of all, how long would that take? And would we be able to look at that maybe side by side with this so that we could have some sense of you know, what it looks like? In other words, if the Gig U was a template, what would ours look like in comparison? Because we're really working in the dark here. We really don't know, you know, what kind of end game we want for ourselves. Exactly.
We need to think about this more.
Okay.
And we need more information.
I'm going to hear from the CIO one more time and then hopefully adjourn before 10 o'clock. No.
Yeah, thanks, Tim, just briefly. Just let me make a suggestion. First of all, I mean, you are all dead on right. This is an enormously valuable asset. So whatever you do, don't sell it. Don't give it away to anybody. But I think, as Terry noted, you know, you can lease some pieces of it. And you still got, I mean, by anybody's assessment, you know, you could lease a piece here, lease a piece there, non-exclusive rights, and you still got a lot of asset left over as long as you don't get rid of it. So that's one key thing. You know, you talk about renting, leasing, whatever, but certainly not about giving over the ownership to the thing. The other thing I was going to suggest is that, there's a lot, as I said earlier, this is still kind of a what-if thing, and we're still trying to, I mean, I've been involved with it over a year, and we're still trying to wrap our mind around where the opportunities are. But I'd like to suggest that if the council could allow for the possibility and leave it with the town manager to decide if it looked promising, or this gigabit squared opportunity looked promising, that we could pursue it with the understanding that it would have to be brought back here for final approval.
That sounds reasonable.
Yeah, I'm pretty comfortable with that. I mean, I think, you know, yeah, it's not, I don't have a problem with
gigabit. We're not slamming the door.
I mean, with the gigabit by squared or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with these squared people. I just don't know who they are, so I don't know whether I have a problem with them.
Yeah, that's right. And we're still trying to understand that ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say we talked about this for several weeks, and I struggled with the same questions that you're struggling with now. You know, how do you commit to something that you don't know what you're committing to? It's not a really good business decision either. While we want to show that we're collaborative and work well together and all that, which is true, we do have other values, like you mentioned here, you know, the digital divide, and so we want to make sure that all of those things are heard. So I think that I could certainly work with that parameter, and trust me, as we find out more, I will definitely be in touch with all of you to make sure you're good with it.
All right.
So, I mean, we're not committing to anything except
no,
for staff
no.
time.
We're not slamming a door. Yeah, we're just learning more.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right.
No,
I agree.
Even if we got the money, you could say, no, we don't want it. We don't like those conditions.
That would just make it harder for us. Then.
won't necessarily be a great idea, but good. Okay. Well, that's something that, it being our basketball and us being able to go home if we can't be captain is, anyway, not new territory.
Move to return.
Third move to return. Seconded. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed.
Aye. Thank you.